State your name and date and place of your birth, and briefly discuss your childhood and any particular people who influenced you in your decision to study music.
Did you say my name?
Yeah.
Oh, Ellsworth Snyder. I was born May the 13th, 1931, in New Carlisle, Ohio, and very shortly thereafter moved to Springfield, Ohio, which is where I actually grew up, went to high school, etc. And you want influences from childhood, but specifically musical ones we're talking
about.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think probably in those years, the biggest influence was a piano teacher by the name of Ralph Zirkel. And I'll speak of two other people as well, one being a woman that I had in junior high school by the name, which is very ironic since I became so interested later, her name was Gertrude E. Stein. And of course, as you know, I have even written about Gertrude Stein. She's one of my great loves. And the other was the high school music choral teacher, Ella Gaver. But as important as these people are, and I can touch on them later, undoubtedly the most important figure was Mr. Zirkel. I did not start piano until quite late. Actually, I think I may have been 12 years old. And since my sister had studied classical piano and it hadn't particularly taken, my parents thought that I should begin with a popular music teacher. And there was at that time a woman who played on the radio. And so she also came to the house, and I had a year of lessons with her. And it was, of course, this thing where you read chord symbols, play melodies, and improvise in the left hand. And then I had appendicitis and was in the hospital. And when I was well again, I went to my parents and said, I didn't want to study popular music. I wanted to study classical music. And there was at this time this very, very fine teacher in Springfield, Ralph Zirkel, who had studied with some very famous people, both in this country and in Europe. And so I was taken to audition for him. And he said that he thought I was very talented, but that I had such bad habits that he would only take me 6 weeks on trial, or perhaps it was 6 months, but you know, something like that. And I wound up being with him 5 years. And he was the old-fashioned type that we no longer have, and that is someone who yelled and screamed and was extremely severe and demanding. And I, of course, wanted very much to please him, and I tried to work to do so, which was no easy task. And he made me stay home a year before I went to the conservatory because he didn't think I was ready to go to music school. He himself had been well known as an accompanist and also as part of a duo piano team, which had given us, and they had given a successful town hall debut in New York. And of course, in those days, town hall was the recital hall in New York outside of Carnegie Hall. And unfortunately, she fell and broke her wrist, and it was also at the time of the Depression, so that completely scuttled their career. And he came back to Springfield and started teaching the piano. So he was undoubtedly the most important early influence. Now, I don't know how much you would want to know about him or about studying with him.
Well, when did you first realize that you wanted to make music your career?
You know, I don't really know. I don't really remember when I didn't. I remember that when I was very little, and I spent a great deal of my youth playing by myself. Of course, in those days, one didn't have quite so many entertainments at one's beck and call. And I do remember that very early on, I used to play as if I were the music supervisor. And in those days in the public schools in Springfield, your regular teacher would teach music, but there was a music supervisor who also came and checked on things. There was also an art supervisor. There was a handwriting supervisor. Yes, yes, very interesting. So, I remember very early on, one of the things I wanted to do was play that I was the music supervisor. I don't know. And I don't remember exactly the chronology in terms of Gertrude Stein and Mr. Zirkle. But I do remember that in the seventh, I had already started studying, I'm sure, studying with Mr. Zirkle before Gertrude Stein. But I do remember that in the seventh grade, we were already listening to Brahms symphonies. So it was a... And I do also remember that in the seventh grade, we were all made to take the Seashore music test. Do you know about that? It was supposedly a test that showed whether or not you were gifted or not. And I remember so well that I didn't do spectacularly well on this examination. And we all had to go up individually to the desk to be told. And Gertrude Stein said to me, that I, of course, had not been brilliant on this examination, but she said to me, "You are, but I know you're going to be a musician. I can tell by your eyes." And she was also the old school temperamental, you know, I mean, she threw things. And, but Mr. Zirkle was very fine, and very difficult man. But he's the one that talked a great deal about relaxation in terms of technique and, you know, musicianship, style, all this kind of thing. And he had a number of very fine students, and every year had a number of students that went off to conservatories, etc. And he had several students who actually became well known. One was a woman who won the National Federation of Music Clubs, you know, contest, and had a town hall debut and all these things. So he was really very good. Not perfect.
Well. In spite of your rather late start at piano, you were able to attend the Cincinnati Conservatory. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to attend that specific conservatory?
Well, that was really Mr. Zirkle's decision. You know, in those days, the teachers were great authorities, and they really regulated your life. You know, I was not allowed to do anything without Mr. Zirkle's permission. They set a course for you, so to speak, and Mr. Zirkle thought that Mr. Goldsand, Robert Goldsand, the pianist, who was then teaching at the Cincinnati Conservatory, would be someone for me to study with. And he arranged for us to go down, and I played for him, and he accepted me, and then the next year that's where I went. But it was Mr. Zirkle's decision. I'm always amazed these days that students even come to universities now with no idea about with whom they'll study. They go to the school and then they take a teacher. And you see, when I was young, you went to a teacher and you simply went to the school where the teacher was, which strikes me as a much more sensible idea.
I'm inclined to agree.
So,
could you say something more about Goldsand?
Yes, certainly. Robert Goldsand was a quite well-known pianist. He was a prodigy, and he was a student of Moritz Rosenthal, who was one of the most famous Liszt pupils. And he was a much, much different personality than Mr. Goldsand, I mean, than Mr. Zirkle. He was, what should I say, he was an old-fashioned aristocratic gentleman type, you know, a person of great culture, and of course he was Austrian, was Viennese actually, and he was not a yeller and a screamer and a pounder on the piano, you know what I mean, a pounder or a slapper of hands. On the other hand, you always knew if he were pleased or displeased, but he tended to do it, you know, in a less than irate way. He was really a wonderful man, and the emphasis, of course, changed considerably. Mr. Goldsand had obviously his own ideas about technique and was famous for, you know, recording all the Chopin etudes and, you know, and so forth. And he was a particularly, you know, the 19th century pianists had such an interest in tone, beauty of tone, and in legato. These are, I think, things that have been moderately well lost. And so a great deal of his emphasis was on this, but also on musical elements. And he had a very original mind, so that I came to observe music in new ways, and to think about music in ways which I had never thought with Mr. Zirkle. Of course, I was much younger with Mr. Zirkle. And this opened, I think, great new vistas for me. He left the conservatory after my freshman year, and then I went to New York several summers and studied with him at the Manhattan School of Music. And I also went several summers to various places where he was giving master classes, you know, and I'd go and spend so many weeks and study with him. And I kept in touch with him until his death, which was actually only, well, I guess now it will be 2 years ago, at the age of 80. And whenever I'd go to New York, we would visit, and he was always very good to me. After he left, and he did want me to come to New York, actually, and that's probably what I should have done, but I didn't. Then I studied with Jano Takács, who is also well known as a composer. And, well, in between, for just a semester maybe, I studied with a man by the name of Lyshenevsky, who was very elderly then. He had been a pupil of Mikuli, you know, the Chopin pupil. But he and I did not really get on. And anyway, so then when I graduated, I really graduated with Mr. Takacs, but I was going as often as I could to also have lessons with Mr. Goldsand. And then also this summer after my senior year, I went to Aspen to study with Rudolf Virkushne. And I spent a whole summer with him, and that was, again, broadening out, so to speak. And in terms of people that particularly influenced me a great deal keyboard-wise, the other person was Madame Alice Ehlers. And I spent two summers with her at the University of Southern California. I went to study with her because she was a harpsichordist, and she was well known for that period of music. And I was very unhappy with my Bach playing. And so I went to study Bach with her. So I spent two summers studying nothing but Bach with her. While I was at USC, I took a few lessons with John Crown, who was also a Rosenthal pupil. And then that was 1 year, and then 1 year, a few lessons with another pianist from a German pianist who was living in Brazil. But primarily I was there to study with Madame Ehlers, and this was wonderful. I really did adore her. But of course she was again old school, very, very severe and demanding. But as in most cases, the harder she was on you, the more she thought you had possibilities. So if she really raked you over, in the long run, you felt it quite a privilege, because it meant that she was interested in you. But anyway, we've drifted a little bit here. But anyway, also at the conservatory, however, I think I should mention that's when I began my lifelong interest in contemporary music, and that was through the young man who had come to teach for his first year of teaching music history at the conservatory, and his name is Charles Ham. It's a well-known name now, but at that time he was just starting out. But in addition to music history, he, at that point in his life, this is actually before all of the books, etc., he was primarily composing. And I gave first performance of things of his, but more than that, he wrote things for me that I gave first performance of.
How was this repertory received at the conservatory? What was the atmosphere of the conservatory, rather?
The atmosphere of the conservatory was of a German 19th century conservatory. And Mr. Goldsand was probably the most advanced, in quotation marks, in terms of repertoire, though he only went so far. But most of the teachers there thought that Debussy and Rachmaninoff were as far as one could possibly go. Maybe a little Shostakovich if you were, you know, terribly wicked. But Charlie Ham, I always tell the story that he invited me. He was also newly married then, and he invited me over one evening, and I had dinner with them and so forth, and then he said he had something he wanted me to listen to. And he put on this piece, and it was certainly like nothing I had ever heard in my life. But I also was extremely fascinated by it. It happens to have been the Webern piano variations. And I then actually played them on my senior recital. And in the interim, as I say, my freshman year, I gave a recital, which was very unusual then for a freshman. And I played a piano sonata that he had written, which had never been performed on that recital. And then the next year, he wrote a piece for me for piano and brass ensemble, which I did with the school's brass ensemble, and so forth. And he opened it, and he wrote a piece for me to open my graduate recital. And actually, you know, he has just retired from Dartmouth. And a year ago, last June, so I guess it'd be 2 years ago this June, there was a conference in his honor in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. And I was one of the 50 people who were asked to come and spend a weekend. And I played two pieces that he had written for me. It was very interesting because most of the people there know him only as a musicologist. And everyone was there that was there were delivering papers. Everyone who was there was delivering papers. But instead I played. And I played the piece that he'd written for me to open my graduate recital. And I played a piece that he wrote for me much later, which is also on the only recording I ever made, a piece called Something Else for Ellsworth Snyder, which is made out of cutting up 19th century American parlor music. So it was really quite fun, and I remain very fond of Charlie.
How was your schooling at the conservatory funded?
By my parents. And you know, it was such a different type thing. As I say, it was a 19th century German type conservatory. The concept was, you know, you went there to become an artist. And I lived in the men's dorm, which was very small. Every room had a piano. There was maid service. Because you were not supposed to have any worries except becoming, you know, a great pianist. So, unfortunately, it didn't quite work, but it was a beautiful concept and a kind of concept that is, you know, completely gone. Also, most of the faculty at that point, many of the faculty, had big ties to the 19th century. I mean, you know, I studied on ensemble music with Jean Tenhoff, who had been a pupil of Isai, and you know, and there was a lot of this kind of connection. So the atmosphere really was so much different than it is now.
Was your life completely wrapped up in the conservatory experience, or did you have a life outside the conservatory?
Well, you know, in those days, we didn't think so much about having other lives. The idea was to be wrapped up. You know, it wasn't, nowadays, there seems to be much more, what should I say, the idea that you need to find yourself and your identity, and then after that you can kind of have a goal. But in those days it was just the opposite. The idea was you had a goal, and as you went towards that goal you would find your identity. And that's the way it was. Of course, naturally, we partied. And as all young people going through college, you know, you did all your experimentation. And certainly in any music school, there is a lot of experimentation, or at least there certainly was in those days. So that was all part of it. But the emphasis was on some sort of goal. But I had come from a very sheltered existence, so that meant that there was a lot of identity to be discovered. So, and I had not come, you know, from a particularly intellectual or cultural background. So that meant that I was constantly in the process of discovering. I mean, to discover that people read, for instance, was a major discovery. That people would practice 6-7 hours a day, and the rest of the time they were reading the great literature and discussed in very substantial terms Greek tragedy or, you know. And I think that's, you know, a different atmosphere than now. Perhaps I'm wrong, but.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about the conservatory before we move on?
I don't know. That's, I mean, otherwise we'd have to get into more specific areas.
Well, after you graduated, you served in the Army.
After I got my master's. I got both my bachelor's and master's in piano at the conservatory.
And what years were those?
I got my bachelor's in 54 and my master's in 55. And then I was drafted in September of 55. This was, in a way, unfortunate because during the summer, I had played for Thor Johnson, who was then conductor of the Cincinnati Symphony, and he was going to use me as a soloist with the Cincinnati Symphony in, you know, at a concert of some kind. I'm sure not one of the big subscription concerts, but, you know, and this would have been a very important thing. After all, Cincinnati Symphony is a major orchestra. But I was drafted. And I was eventually, I was assigned to the infantry. And I shan't go into all my war stories, but Mr. Takach always said that the day I went into the Army was the day Eisenhower had his heart attack. But anyway, I eventually wound up in Japan. And this was during the Korean War. And I wound up in Japan, and it turned out I was sent to an infantry company in Otsu, which is near Kyoto. And I actually was there put on TDY to the regimental chorus, but as an accompanist. But there was a chaplain in Tokyo that in a dependent housing area for officers who wanted me very much as his assistant, you know, and to direct a choir and all this kind of stuff in a dependent housing area. And he, it's a long story which I won't go into except that I got to go there because the Army would not let me go, but my dad, in talking to a congressman, asked why it was that they wouldn't let me go, and the congressman said, well, he would look into it. And the one thing that the Army doesn't like is congressional investigations. So I was sent literally overnight from Otsu to Tokyo and was, you know, chaplain's assistant at the Washington Heights Chapel for the rest of the time that I was in.
So you were able to keep up with your musical, you were able to stay in shape pianistically?
Well, I can't say that, no. I can't say that, because I had, of course, a full-time chapel job, plus I had the choir, and so forth, and I tend not to be good if there are lots of distractions. I tend to have to zero in, and I really have to practice a lot to play decently. So And if I have a lot of distractions, it's very hard. I have to have consistency. But, of course, there were pianos there. I could practice, I guess, some. And I did a little, but not really anything too much. I did play a couple times. In fact, since we're doing this for the University of Wisconsin, Mr. Karp's former college roommate by the name of Thomas Still was someone I knew in Tokyo. And there was a USO there, and there was a woman at the USO who was a pianist. Roberta Rux, I think, R-U-X. Anyway, she would arrange programs. And there were a few people in the Tokyo area that played, and she arranged this program. And Tom played on it, and some other people. And one of Howard's favorite stories about me is that at a serviceman's club, we gave this concert, and what did I play? I played the Webern Variations. I think I also played maybe a little Chopin or something, but you know. And naturally, this was hardly fair for the average serviceman. But I did do music in the sense of choir, and we did some special programs and things like that. And in fact, years ago here, John Payton was on the faculty, a tenor. He was just recently in town, and he now is at US, teaches at USC in Los Angeles. But he and I had gone to school together, and he was in the Navy, and the ship docked, and I used him as my tenor soloist on the Christmas, at the Christmas Eve concert. So anyway, there are all these Wisconsin connections in a way.
Following your experience in the Army, you taught at
East Tennessee State
mm-hmm. and later at Tulane. Mm-hmm.
Well, Newcomb College.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you'd like to discuss your experiences.
Well, sure. I went to East Tennessee State, which is in Johnson City. Actually, that's where Roland Johnson comes from, you know. And he, by the way, was at the College of Music in Cincinnati around the same time I was. And he was at one time conductor of the Springfield, Ohio Symphony when Walter Hermann, who was the first conductor here, he was first cellist of the Cincinnati Symphony. His brother, Emil Hermann, was the concertmaster. They were came from a family who knew Brahms. Roland Johnson was a a student of these people, and when I was still in Springfield, he conducted a concert of the Springfield Symphony Orchestra in which Emil and Walter Hermann played the Brahms Double Concerto. And then Walter Hermann was the conductor of the Madison Symphony. And when he retired is when Roland Johnson came here to conduct. So anyway, it's a connection, you know, that is, I think, of some interest, actually. So anyway, I went to, and Roland's violin teacher in Johnson City was a graduate of the Cincinnati Conservatory who, when I was a student there, still came back every summer and studied violin and piano. Elsie Arts, A-R-T-Z. So, anyway, I went to Johnson City, to East Tennessee State. I was there 2 years. I taught piano, music theory, and directed the college glee club. I got on there fabulously with the students. I did not get on well with the head of the department. I have to, of course, say that I was very young and very much like a bull in a china shop. And when you're young, you're convinced, of course, that you can save the world. And I felt that he was primarily a band man and was not really so interested in music as art, you know? So naturally for me, I thought of him as being pretty low level. And he naturally thought of me as an elitist snob. So we rubbed, shall we say. And also he would do things like, every year he conducted a community version of the Messiah. And would do things at rehearsal like, say, well, you've all sung this, I'll just talk you through it. So they never, you know. Well, things like this at my stage were outrageous. So we didn't get on very well. So at the end of 2 years, I left. And I did not get a job for a year and was simply at home. And then I got a job, actually through Charlie Hamm, at Newcomb College, which is the women's division of Tulane University. At least at that time, Tulane was strictly a men's school, and Newcomb was a women's school. They're on the same campus. The president of Tulane was over both, but Newcomb had its separate dean. And I was there 4 years. And I did like it very much. Of course, I was young, and Charlie was there. We did a lot of interesting things, a lot of interesting music. And I had some very interesting students. And of course, I loved New Orleans. I guess it would be pretty hard when you're young not to love New Orleans. But anyway, that was also important in the sense that that's where I met Kate, who has loomed so large, I don't want to slight adverbs. Well, anyway, it was in 1960 or 61, actually, that he and David Tudor came to do a concert, and that's when I first met Cage.
What did you teach at Newcomb?
At Newcomb, I taught strictly piano. Strictly piano.
When did you first come to Madison, and why?
I came to Madison in September of 1964. Well, I had decided 2 or 3 years before that I should get a doctor's degree. I don't understand why now, but then I thought it very important. And the 2 summers I spent at USC were, in a sense, I was thinking that I would go there for a DMA. But the last year that I was going to be in New Orleans, I was involved in an accident which severed the long tendon of my third finger in the right hand. And I had to have surgery for that, you know, to have it put back, and then I had to do a lot of physical therapy, and I couldn't play for a year. But at this point, I had already severed relationship with the university, with Newcomb. So someone who had taught with me there had come to teach here, plus the fact that John Payton was here. And McPeak, Gwynne McPeak, who then went from here, he was a professor of musicology, he then went from here to Michigan. He called and said, now that you may never play again, I shall never forget that. That was his approach. Why don't you come here and get a PhD? Because at that time, here, they didn't offer a DMA. And besides that, academic people consider DMAs not entirely legitimate. They think a PhD is the proper academic degree. And he said, I'll see that you get a teaching assistantship. So that's what I did. I came. And here I am. So I came in the fall of 1964, and I finally got my PhD in 1970, and I wrote the first doctoral dissertation on Cage. And in the interim, while all that was going on, I played a great deal. Even concertized some in Europe, and started teaching at Milton College at that time. I don't know the exact date, but I must have taught at Milton for about 13 years, something like that anyway. And at first it was all part-time, and it was only towards the end that it was a fuller appointment. Those, of course, were very heady days because of all the protests and so forth. And it was a perfect moment for somebody who was interested in avant-garde things, because at that point, everyone was. All the students, and it was a quite exciting time. And I taught piano as a TA, and also taught some theory and appreciation courses, and I had a fantastic appreciation course that I said, well, okay, I'll divide you up, those that want to be in a conventional course and those who want to be in an experimental course. And the experimental course had one semester 50 and the next semester 250, and was very exciting. I have to say that that was an extremely exciting time. And then I continued to teach at Milton, and I got the degree. Then I started here at the First Unitarian as music director, and I was both at Milton College and here. Then I guess, and taught piano privately, and of course Milton eventually closed. That was 80 or 81?
Was it 82? I think it was 82.
Well, it was, the last year there was only one music person. So, whatever the year before it closed.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And I was 1 year visiting professor at the university. And then Milton closed, and then I just simply remained as music director, First Unitarian Plus, teaching piano privately, and playing concerts.
Can you say something more about your experimental section?
The experimental section?
Specifically, some of the things.
The class was not made up of musicians, you understand. It was what we would now call a service course type thing. And I took an entirely different track. What we did was, the first class, I gave an assignment. And the assignment was that everyone had to compose a piece that used no known conventional musical instrument, but was some sound-producing media. And that the next class, they should be able to perform it in class. And then at that class, we always sent one person out, and then the piece was performed, okay? And then the next assignment was that they were to go on the assumption that they wanted somebody else to be able to reproduce what they had done. So they must invent a notational system that was appropriate to the materials used that would make it possible by explanation of the notational system for someone else to do it. And then the person who had been sent out was assigned that piece to perform. And it really was marvelous. Then we had, you know, these people perform these pieces, and then we could discuss at least what I thought was happening was that they would really come to understand music from the inside out, because they would understand what composers do, and then they would understand all the things that go into what the composer does. And so, you know, the person would come and perform it, and then we could compare it with what the quotation marks composer had done, and we could discuss the notational systems. And then I tried very much to link all this up with things that were going on at the present time, at that time, and also with things that were going on in the other arts at that time, so that it was interdisciplinary, you know. And so we could oftentimes talk about the notational systems and talk about contemporary drawing, for instance, or this kind of thing. And it really was a wonderful, exciting class, I have to say. And so that was how we did. And then towards the end of the semester, we did a variety of projects. And we did, there was, we built a huge box with a big ribbon, bow and ribbon on it, that fit over the Lincoln statue, you know, at the top of Bascom, so that it would be like a wrapped present, you know. And we did a line of spaghetti all the way down State Street. We did a urinal event that, I guess I won't go into all that, but it was, you know, I mean, it was just very fascinating. And the students really showed their creative, imaginative side. And it was a time when everyone was willing to consider a different idea. We no longer have that. We've become so conservative again, but at that time. And also at the same time, people in the music department and faculty, as well as students, used to give concerts of the most avant-garde, far-out stuff. And we would fill Memorial Union with students, and I mean everywhere. They would even be in the aisles. And they really came to hear the latest thing that was going on. I mean, we did everything, you know, all kinds of Cage, all kinds of, I don't know, Polish avant-garde music. We did just the most far-out things that were happening. We did a lot of conceptual things. It was a very, very, very exciting time.
Do you have any favorite professors that come to mind from your days as a student here?
Someone with whom I have forged a very fine and long friendship was Walter Gray, is Walter Gray. Walter Gray, of course, is now at the North Carolina School of the Arts and has been there for a number of years. But when I was here, he was professor of music history, one of the professors of music history. And let's see, I have to think about it. I also was very interested in philosophy then. I took a minor in philosophy. So practically every philosophy professor I had was of a great deal of interest to me. But they're not all still here, of course. I just ran into Yandell, I don't know if you know that name or not, the other day, and every once in a while I run into him. My minor professor was Ivan Saul. I don't know if you know the philosophy people. But obviously that department has also changed a great deal since then. But I, of course, the person I suppose in the music department who influenced me the most was Rudolf Kolisch. And he was fabulous. A great musician and great mind. And do you know much of Mr. Kolisch? And I studied with him all of the Beethoven string quartets, all of the Schubert string quartets, and all of the Schoenberg, Berg and Webern works. Well, one course was entirely Schoenberg, and then another one was classic dodecaphonic works. And I also had the pleasure of playing with him once. In 1966 was the 100th anniversary of Satie's birth, and I organized an all-Satie concert. And Satie wrote one work for violin and piano, and Mr. Kolisch agreed to play that with me, and that was a wonderful experience. But he was a fabulous musician, and I really can say that he was influential, because it really tied in with so many of the other people with whom I had studied. It was very substantial, and of course he had been so close to the Viennese school, second Viennese school, which was music that interested me and which I did play. And you have to understand that the University of Wisconsin Music Department has not always been, very interested in contemporary music. It also is a quite conservative department. I mean, you can get, now, of course, they have doctor's degrees in applied music, and you could certainly get such a degree with having played practically nothing really contemporary, or certainly nothing far out, which I find not, you know, exactly in the interest of music. But anyway, so I'm just trying to think who else I might cite. I, of course, met here so many interesting musicians. And, of course, I know the music faculty pretty well, though some of the people I have known well are now retiring. Another person that I played for in recital, Bettina Bjorkstrand, I also considered to be a particularly fine musician, and that was certainly a pleasure.
She also is being interviewed for the Oral History Project.
Oh, is she? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I still see Bettina often. And actually, a few years ago, when our friend Edith Frank died, Bettina, even though you know she is, after all, what should I say, maturing, and was not singing any longer in public, did sing three Schubert songs, and I played for her, and it was quite amazing. She's an amazing woman. So, a lot of, and I mean, though it may be that I can't always agree with all the policies, etc., there are certainly many very serious musicians here on the faculty. And
can you speak to changes between now and, say, in the 60s in terms of the curriculum? I mean, aside from the fact that the universities now is offering DMAs, do you see any changes in the curriculum or perhaps the structure of classes?
Well, I suppose the big thing would be all the computerization. See, we had none of that at all. And I don't really know enough about the computerization. It's really outside of my expertise, if I have any. And the little bit that I have seen of it, I think the use of computerization completely changes how one is taught and changes very much the environment. And I would say that's a very, very big change from you know, my day. And I think that the students have changed considerably. There is a certain, I know it's trite to say, but there does seem to be a less intellectual, cultural milieu than there once was. And I also think that the demands are less in certain areas than there used to be. So I don't know. I tend to think that the students, particularly in applied areas, need more fundamental training than they now get, and which they used to get more of. But I think that has changed some, and I'm sure the curriculum has changed in terms of what is thought necessary now. And I think, for instance, the teaching of music history must have changed considerably. I've heard about some of the courses being taught now, which try to sort of make a fusion of various musical styles, including what we would call classical, popular, you know, etc. And certainly that was not the case when I was younger. So I think there's been a lot of change all the way around. And I'm not making a value judgment in the sense that it may be, you know, the right course. And I certainly don't know enough about what's going on at the university right now to make a reasonable judgment at all. Obviously, some very, very fine things, and at the same time, there might be other things that one would regret losing, or maybe there need to be more leaps. I do think that it remains a very conservative bastion.
Well, you've mentioned Milton College. What did you teach there?
Well, I taught piano there and music history. Mm-hmm. And Milton College was a, I think, a very good liberal arts college, particularly in the area of music. And I think what was good about it was that whereas most schools, and I think what the university does, is they have certain levels. And they say, at if you're a freshman, you are at this level. And if you're a sophomore, you must be at this level, etc. And that's all well and good if indeed you are at that level. But if you have to be pressed into being that level, I'm not sure it's good for one's overall long-range development. Whereas at Milton, the idea was you start where the student is and you take them as far as you can take them in the 4 years that you have them, and that this be a substantial step-by-step process so that no matter where they have arrived at the end of those 4 years, I keep using the word substantial. It's solid, I guess. It's solid. There aren't so many things left out in order to make sure that you're at a certain place at a certain time. And I think that for many students, particularly those who have not been well trained prior to school, that this is the best way to go if in terms of long range, you know. The important thing, it would seem to me, is what the student can do 20 years later. And I think the only way they will be able to do whatever it is they want to do 20 years later is if they've had this solid step-by-step procedure. And I understand that's now considered to be an old fogey's eye concept, but I must say I haven't yet lost it. So I think that was the good thing about Milton. And I think that there were also some very devoted teachers there. I think that the teachers really were devoted to teaching. I felt sometimes they interfered too much with the student's life. But, you know, they were, I think, substantially interested in the student's musical upbringing. And it was, it could be, if the students were willing to accept it, I guess, a non-distracting environment, particularly in those years when there were so many distractions. But I think that's also one thing that the students didn't like, which probably was one reason eventually they just didn't have enough students. And as students have had access more and more to just the world, essentially, they don't want to be quite so ascetic. So I think that there were naturally pros and cons, and You know, I mean, there wasn't a great library, and there weren't a lot of great cultural events and so forth, but there was access to such things, but they would have to be gone after, so to speak. And if a student wasn't interested in that, that would make it more difficult. But it was an intimate atmosphere. And if one, if it hooked up well for one, I think it was beneficial.
Do you recall any really outstanding students?
Outstanding students.
Well, present company accepted, of course.
Well, of course. Well, I was going to mention that, present company. You mean of mine? Or of anyone?
Of Milton College.
Of Milton College.
Or from your years.
Well, first of all, we have to immediately say the quarterback of the of the Seahawks.
Jeez.
Obviously, that's what Milton College is famous for. But well, I think there were, and I don't know enough about all the people at Milton College. I primarily only knew the music students.
Well, that's.
You know, but I think there were a lot of music students that went off to do things, many of them teaching in the public schools with great success and doing choral things with great success. Dick Severing, you know, doing all the numerous choral things. We had the young lady who went to New York, sang in the Metropolitan Opera Chorus. Christine Flash. In fact, I just recently saw her at Bernie's funeral. Yeah. And we just had a number of people like that, actually. They went off and did things. A pupil of mine, Maggie Sharnan, became chairman of the music department at the university in Green Bay. And a lot of people did, you know, various and sundry things. So a lot of those people went out and did things. Even in this area, we have a number of them. Well, I think of Joe Bergdorf, who's been teaching for years in the Sun Prairie School, you know, very successfully. And I know there are many, many more. They just, you know, I'm clicking in at the minute to this. I think that the music graduates of Milton College tended, on the whole, to be quite successful. And we're not saying maybe on the world stages, but in terms of successful music education teaching, particularly. And now, and look at yourself. I mean,
what can I say?
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, let's move on to Cage. Do you just want to freeform talk about Tom Cage and his influence on your life?
Well, I met Cage in New Orleans, as I said. And that was, I think, in the spring. And then it just happened, it was that summer that I first went to Los Angeles. And the Cunningham Dancers came, and so I got to see him again, and also tutor. And I corresponded with him a little. And then when I was going to write a dissertation, then it seemed to me that he was somebody I would like to write about. And the primary reason was, as I've often said, that I didn't understand what was going on. Excuse me. And I thought the best way to understand, because I was very, very intrigued by it, it seemed to me terribly interesting and attention-holding and also incomprehensible. And so I decided I just wanted to do more and more of it, and I started performing more of his music. And in fact, the very first year I was here, 1964, was the first time that I did any cage in his presence. At that time, the University of Illinois had a biannual contemporary festival. I don't know if they still have it or not. It was a big thing in those days. And Cage was one of the invited composers, and Charlie Hamm was at that time then teaching at the University of Illinois. And I was invited to do the concert for piano and orchestra, which is a major Cage piece. And then I started working on the dissertation, and all these things just sort of congealed. And so ever since, I have performed and lectured about and written about his things. And I remained in touch with him for over 30 years then, until he died. And he did also write a piece for me. And he came here when I did the all. Did you come to that? Oh, that's really too bad. I did an all Cage concert, and in addition played the first performance of the piece he had written for me. And we had an exhibit of some of his visual art at the all. And in studying Cage's work, I became extremely enthralled with the ideas. And I think those ideas sort of seeped into my own ways of thinking and tended to influence me a great deal. I don't know what specifically,
Just out of curiosity, how was your dissertation topic received by your doctoral committee?
Well, you have to understand that at that time there was no one here who knew anything about it. And I, of course, think the dissertation is very poor. And certainly I would now do something entirely different. And I also think there are errors in it which even now need to be corrected. But anyway, it was at that time, something new. Well, I can, for instance, explain to you that at that time the Badura Skodas were here. And Eva Badura Skoda, is a musicologist. And she wanted very much for me to do my dissertation with her, but only if I would change topics. Particularly, she wanted me to change to Schoenberg. Mm. But I started the dissertation with Larry, with Larry Gushy. And I don't know if I would ever finished it, if it wouldn't be the fact that he went away one summer and Walter Gray stepped in for him. And so we finished it and got it done. I didn't relate well to Gushy. He was a very bright man, interesting man. But we just weren't really on the same wavelengths. So I finished with Walter. And my committee was all right. And it included, of course, someone from the philosophy department. And the only person that we thought would give any trouble was Vera Milovic, who, do you know that name? He's a Byzantine scholar, very famous Byzantine scholar, music scholar. And Walter said, we can't be sure he will sign. And I had a two-hour defense, and everyone signed, and Professor Veronovic said, well, you can make anything seem reasonable. So, that was it. But also, by that time, I had sort of established myself as a credible avant-gardist, mm-hmm. you know. And the times were still open enough that people were willing to consider these things a little bit. But it's true, it was not ordinary. And I think that a lot of the people didn't think of that they might not, you know, have felt this was good stuff, mm-hmm. so to speak, you know, but they were willing to bend enough.
Backing up to your experimental section, I'm sure that people in the class are going to want to know about the urinal event. Would you like to go into detail about that? Or?
Sure, why not? In those days we were, you know, not too shy. The urinal event was a piece for, I forget exactly how many males, and the directions, they were each to go and find a found object, okay? And then they were to put the found object inside their shorts, okay? And the idea was that one at a time, at various times, there were, you know, there was a time chart. They were to go into the main John in the Union and go up to a urinal and unzip their pants and reach in and pull out whatever found object was there and hold it in front of them as if they were urinating. Now, as you know, part of the psychology in men's room is that there's a great urge to peer and look at the fellow next to you or down the way or whatever. Just, you know, no matter how quick the glance. So naturally, this happened and rather undid some poor people witnessing this. Anyway, and then they were to put it back in their pants, zip up, and then go to the cloakroom and check the object. And this was the urinal event. And it was, by all accounts, quite a success.
Yes. Okay. Moving from the sublime to the ridiculous. Is there anything about the music scene in Madison that you see as special or different from other cities of similar size, demography?
Well, I mean, I suppose the only differences would be that you have a major university. So that means there is a certain amount of audience and a certain amount of things going on that you might not have, say, in a town the same size which didn't have such an educational institution. I think that the musical scene in Madison, I take it you mean the musical scene,
is
primarily a conservative one. Madison, for all of its bragging about liberal and progressive political stances, etc., is not really that much so in the arts. It's a pretty conservative town, I think, for the arts. There are a lot of interesting people here, however, but they're not always well represented or, you know, shown, etc. It's surprising. But you do also have to remember that in the arts, art and literature tend to be much more open to new ideas than, say, music or literature. Music and literature always tend to be more behind. Or if they're not behind, they don't get the immediate exposure. We really live in a visual age, and it's easier to make visual changes than it is to make sound changes. But there are a lot of interesting people in Madison, but I don't find the arts scene as vital as it could be if it were less conservative and were livelier and more open and more willing to take risks. You cannot have a healthy arts scene unless you're willing to take risks. And if everything, as it more and more becomes, bottom line, money, it is true that people will praise your administrative abilities, but I think what eventually will not be praised is what you have done for the arts. And I am not convinced that arts administration degrees are any kind of answer, because I think that actually they have made things much worse, because the emphasis is on business, not on art. And I'm sorry to say that the arts don't survive in an atmosphere in which you can't be wrong. You must give an artist permission to do what he has to do.
Do you see your role as Unitarian music director and some of the series you put on here as an attempt to take risks, as you say?
Well, I think we don't take a lot of risks here either. We do, at least in terms of our own music program. Well, I do commission things, you know, sometimes. I mean, we've done I've had a work for choir by Jackson McLowe, you know, the first poet to use chance operations. And well, I mean, recently we Stephen Chapman, professor of composition at British Columbia, wrote a piece for the choir. You know, we an Atlanta composer, Mark Gresham, etc. I mean, we do some of this, but it's pretty minimal. I do a very wide range of literature, however, and I do a lot of conventional type literature, but not the literature that is normally done. And so this at least broadens that horizon. Then we do have. We were instrumental in having Present Music from Milwaukee come and do a series of concerts here. They now have for 2 years, and will, as far as I know, do it again next year. And the Oakwood Chamber Players now also do a series here. And of course, I've done things here, like all cage concerts, and you know, and this type of thing. And we have a wonderful summer concert series. Anyway, which has given the community very fine summer series of concerts. But the music is, and this year will be our 20th anniversary, we're going to do a big series, but it's primarily conventional, but not necessarily everyday conventional, you know. But in terms of really far out, I can't say that. I have myself done a number of things. You know, I did a big Fluxus concert at the Art Center and this kind of thing. But
well, just in closing, what are some of your current activities outside of music?
Outside of music? Well, you know, I've gotten, actually through influence of Cage, I've gotten into doing visual art. And last November I had a show here. And I've just come back from New York, where a painting of mine is in a show that Cage wrote for museums. It's called Roly Holy Over, a circus. And that name comes from Finnegan's Wake. And I have a painting in that, and I loan them, you know, some other things, etc. So I do that, and I've had some things published recently in terms of an article on Gertrude Stein that came out in a new book on Stein, and then I had something come out in a book called Conversations, Conversing with Cage, also an old article of mine on Cage and Stein together has just come out in a new book on Cage from the University of Michigan Press. And things like that. And the catalog for this big Cage show, which opened in Los Angeles, and I went out and played an all-Cage concert, was on a panel. And it went to Houston. Now it's in at the Guggenheim in Soho, and then it goes to Japan, and then the Philadelphia Museum. The catalog for that is a box. It's an aluminum box, and it's filled with all these various and sundry things, including my chronology of his life. And you know, I do a lot of things. I just did a lecture at the Madison Arts Center on composers who paint. And things like that.
Okay.
So I managed to try to stay busy.
Wonderful.
But not out of mischief.
Oh, no, of course. I would hope not. Thank you.
Thank you.